Welcome to the Native Habitat Podcast. If you've even got the slightest interest in the outdoors, you're in the right place. We're your hosts, Kyle Leiberger
and Jake Brown. Get ready to hit the field with folks like us who have a passion for wildlife, plants, and native habitat.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the Native Habitat Podcast. We've got a guest here this week that I've known for quite a while. I've been on their podcast. They're a huge supporter of the Native Habitat Project, and early on, they were a big help selling T-shirts, actually, I think, and using the money for that for conservation. And I was thankful enough to, I was pretty excited. They selected me, I guess, the first for their first donation, so that was pretty awesome. This is Tom Knizek here with the Native Plants Healthy Planet Podcast. I got too many native things going on. The Native Habitat Managers, Native Habitat, Native Plant Talk, Native Habitat Project, Native Habitat Podcast. It's like it runs together, man. But
oh yeah, it gets a lot really jumbled up when you have all this stuff going on, and then ours is like Native Plants Healthy Planet presented by Pines Nursery. And then we have the different kinds of episodes going on. It gets pretty confusing. Yeah. So I don't blame you for that at all. But thank you guys for having me on. I wish I was down there in the beetle barn talking in person. It looks awesome from this Skype view I have. But.
Well, it is until it gets about 200 degrees in here. You can tell some of our podcast episodes. I start getting a little distracted because I start sweating so much. I can't think about what I'm going to say because I get so hot. But I've been a long time fan of y'all's podcast. And the first time I was on y'all's podcast, at the end, y'all were like, you need to start a podcast. And I was like, yeah, right. No, that'll never happen. It was like the last thing on my mind at the time. I had, so much going on making videos and creating short content, but then I kind of came to the realization, these longer formats are really useful for, explaining native ecosystems to people. But you've grown up in it your entire life, haven't you?
Yeah, but I took it for granted my entire life too, up until a couple of years ago. But it's I had a thought there, but I completely blanked on what I was going to say. So I'll let you keep going, Colin.
Welcome to the club. Get ready for that to happen a bunch. How long has Pinelands Nursery been a thing, and how long have y'all had a podcast?
Yeah, so my parents actually started Pinelands Nursery in 1983, so we're coming up on 40 years being in business. And it wasn't always a native plant nursery. My dad was a Rutgers graduate, and he actually joined the New Jersey Forest Service and was working in the Pine Barrens, which is a unique ecosystem we have here in New Jersey. And but one of the things agriculturally that happens in the Pine Barrens is there's a lot of blueberry growers. It's really awesome soil for growing blueberries. And he just made friends with some of these blueberry growers. Back in the 80s, there wasn't a lot to do. You don't have cell phones and computers, and you only had three channels on the TV. So he would just drive around and meet people down there, and he met some of these blueberry growers and just started growing blueberries on his own to sell at Rutgers. Had a event called Ag Field Day, where the Ag School would basically invite some alumni back, kind of have like a little fair and festival. You could be a vendor and sell stuff. So he said, I'm going to go and grow these blueberry plants to sell them there. And then just kind of grew into it. And eventually had a landscaper who was doing some work in the Pine Barrens said, I can only use plants that are on this list of plants that are native to the Pine Barrens. Would you be interested in growing some other stuff? And from there, he kind of had like a fruit seedling business that he was selling some garden centers, and then kind of shifted gears and said, you know what, I kind of prefer to do this. And like you, Kyle, he self-taught himself. He was knew his trees, but he didn't know very many herbaceous plants. So he went through and just taught himself all these herbaceous plants, just walking through meadows and picking stuff out, and didn't have iNaturalist, so he'd have to go and collect samples and look it up in a book and figure out what it was. And I think he just taught himself all this stuff. And then my mom, like I said, they started together. She basically financed the whole thing. She was working in New York City and and paid for it all so he could do what he wanted to do, and then eventually quit her job because the nursery just started to take off.
Yeah, man, that's awesome. That that's I didn't realize he was in the forest industry or was a forester. I've listened to Tony L's podcast. I guess I never caught that, but that's how I started. I think it's like a pride thing when you know all your trees and people are asking you these tree names, and then you know, then you realize that you don't know this whole other realm of native plants. You can't identify all these wildflowers and grasses and things. And I think that's kind of what piqued my interest in it. And I was like, this is like a whole new world that we never even learned in forestry school. We just learned the trees and that was it. But man, that's so he's been in the native plant scene, I mean, way before native plant nurseries or the native plant movement had started. And man, that's an incredible story. And to focus on the pine barren ecosystems to begin with, that's, to me, that's what's so awesome, is like creating a business surrounding a type of ecosystem that's in your state. That's just really incredible. And then I guess how long have y'all had the podcast?
So yeah, we started the podcast, it was February 2020, and actually similar to your story where you said you were listening to ours and we had you on after you started the TikTok channel. And I said, oh, you should do one of these too. I just always listen to a lot of podcasts, and particularly I like being in the outdoors. I really like to hunt and fish, so I listened to a lot of hunting podcasts because I wasn't very good at it, and that was a way for me to learn and say, well, basically figure out, I'll listen to these people who are really good at hunting and then learn how to get better. And I started out listening to like the Meat Eater podcast, and then they had another one called Wire to Hunt, which is particularly white-tailed deer focused. And then it just kind of clicked. Somehow I stumbled across upon the Land and Legacy podcast because I met Dr. Dwayne Estes from the Southeastern Grasslands Initiative. I think he put on LinkedIn he was on there. I'm like, oh, this seems right up my alley. And then I was like, oh, this is great because you have hunting and native plants, two worlds that I'm really involved with colliding in one. This is perfect for me. And as I was listening to that episode that they had with Dwayne Estes, I'm like, man, we talked to a lot of really cool people. We could do this. Fran, or my co-host on Native Plants Healthy Planet, had a music podcast, so he already had the equipment, knew how to do it. I figured I could figure it out because I listened to so many. And that's kind of how it started, was just, hey, well, I know Dwayne. We could call him up and have him on our podcast. And here's a list of 20 other people that we came up with. That was our first list of folks that were like, man, these kind of have really similar stories. And then the goal there was, there's so many people who are interested, not even native plants, but something outdoors related. And it all ties back to native plants at the end of the day. And while they couldn't, we were a wholesale business, so we're only selling to landscapers primarily, and nonprofits, that kind of thing. So if someone on the street was drove into our driveway, they couldn't buy anything from us, but they could go and volunteer with the Xerx Society or donate to the Xerx Society or Southeastern Grasslands Initiative or all these different nonprofits. They could work with them. And then it allowed us to kind of, the marketing side of things was, oh, I could call up some of these places that we wanted to work with and say, oh, we could have you on our podcast. And so it wasn't just a one-way thing. It was a bunch of different stuff. But the big thing was getting the word out about native plants. And you might not be interested in plants, but you like butterflies. That's how a lot of people got drawn, is they love monarch butterflies. Was directly tied back to a native plant. Or you like the fish, or you like the hunt.
Yeah,
it's directly drawn back to the ecosystems and the habitats these things have. You can't build it out of things that they don't need and hope that the deer or the turkeys or the fish or the butterflies come to it. You need to give them the plants that they want,
man. And that's harder, unfortunately. Drawing hunters into the native plant world it's harder than it sounds, because they should be invested in it big time, but that's not, as hunters, you know, I guess all three of us here are hunters. As hunters, that's when we're consuming, you know, hunting related content and, you know, TV shows, YouTube, social media, where we're getting preached to so hard about other things besides native ecosystems. I think that's kind of the, what makes it so hard to get hunters on board. But man, that's to me, it's awesome that you hunt and that you have a native plant podcast, and you contribute to the Native Habitat Managers group. And man, that's like, that's really how I started a couple years ago. I think it was maybe the beginning of 2021, but when we started the Native Habitat Managers group, that's where we were wanting to bring in hunters, kind of collide those worlds of native plant folks, birders, botanists, foresters, hunters, and all those folks, and just get them all talking about native ecosystems, because hunters aren't as knowledgeable about managing native ecosystems as, you know, a botanist or, you know, somebody who's out there managing grasslands like Dwayne Estes. And when you get those kind of folks together and getting that knowledge spread around the hunting community, I think it's an awesome thing, because that's such a huge group. Hunters already do so much for conservation. They're already out there on properties doing work. I think that's a group we should focus on even more, you know, bringing them over to the good side for native ecosystems and stuff. But so y'all's nursery, y'all are selling to mostly wholesalers, you said, so y'all aren't selling to individuals, mostly, but how many species y'all grow, and what species are y'all growing mostly?
So we grow about a little over 200 individual species. We grow a lot of herbaceous plants, so are flowers, like wildflowers and grasses, grasses, sedges, and rushes. And then we have a lot of woody plants we grow as well. So we have trees and shrubs too. And the reason, like I said, my parents started this, the reason they did that is there's no one else who is really selling native plants or growing native plants in our area. As I've gotten more invested in the nursery and seed business side of things, I've noticed a trend that a lot of these the native plant nurseries you've heard of around the country, they all popped up right around the same time. And it was basically due to legislation at the federal level and even the state levels, where there was more an emphasis on clean water, clean air, cleaning up the environment. But it's all basically really late 70s to probably like 1990, you just had a flurry of all these native plant nurseries pop up. And but for New Jersey and the Mid-Atlantic, there really weren't a lot of options. So you kind of had to supply or grow everything, because you'd have a landscaper came in and they're doing a restoration project along the Delaware River. Well, oh, I need these 1,000 trees, and I also need these 10,000 herbaceous plants. So it was a way to kind of get them to just get it from us, because they really didn't have many other places to go. So we grow a little over 200 individual species, and then split up between the herbaceous and then the woody plants. And then we also have a small seed farm where we're growing primarily herbaceous plants. There's a handful of woody plants we grow, so just to collect the seed off of, and then sell the seed to those same general customers.
Man, that's awesome. So that kind of leads us into a topic or a series, I guess, we're wanting to start here with the podcast, where we interview or talk to native plant experts in each state. And you're in New Jersey, and y'all's, you know, primary, I guess, ecosystems y'all are restoring are pine barrens. And so, you know, there's probably people in New Jersey that don't even know about pine barrens, aren't there? Is that the case there, or are they more popular
it's definitely a case in New Jersey, because it's a fairly rural area.
Yeah.
And it's an ecosystem we're lucky to have, because I think it was back in the 70s, there was actually a call to actually build a mega airport there for the East Coast, kind of take some of the pressure off of the New York City airports. We're not too far from Philadelphia, really not too far from like Baltimore and DC when you really think about it. So it was a way to kind of have like a mega airport, and they wanted to basically pave over like tens of thousands of acres of New Jersey pine barrens. But they eventually didn't, primarily because it protects a really important aquifer. We have, you figure, it's basically a giant sand filter. The soil's very, very sandy. I don't know the exact breakdown, but it's probably like 90% sand, if not more. So that water will percolate into the aquifer fairly quick, so they wanted to make sure there weren't a lot of contaminants. Was a big thing. And then you have a really unique plant community because it's a lot of pitch pine. There's a lot of oaks in there.
What kind of oaks y'all have mostly?
There's some red oaks. There's some white oaks. I'm not as much of a forester as my dad is, and definitely not as much as you guys. So I know there's a couple names that I can't remember off the top of my head.
What are the Latin names on those?
Yeah. So you have Quercus rubra, and then Quercus alba for red and white.
See, but you're pretty close. You're more of a forester than most people.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just from working in the business. Really is. We joke around all the time. There's plants that have. Well, the same botanical name, obviously, but if I was referred to it by its common name, you'd have a completely different common name just being in a different part of the country. Yeah. So that's why we use them. So a lot of people here, especially in our sales department, they could tell you all about a plant, but if they saw one in the wild, they couldn't tell you that's what it looked like when they went out there. Yeah. If you're walking through the woods, they couldn't tell you that. Oh yeah, that's what I know so much about. Yeah. And I was like that with the seed for a long time before I started really going through and looking at a lot of herbaceous plants and saying, okay, this is what Juncus officinus is, and now I can know where it grows, and I know all the statistics about it, but couldn't actually identify it.
Things tend to look different in pots and stuff when you're growing them in plugs than they do in the wild, and when you put them somewhere where they're even, like, from, like, glades or dry areas around here, a plant can look different than it could somewhere else where it's getting more, nutrients or more water or something. And so even, out in the wild, plants can look different, and that can kind of confuse people a lot of times. But that's one of our goals, I guess, with this series is to get, I think it was y'all's podcast who talked about, having pride, in ecosystems that are native to your area. And so, that's obviously something folks in your state should be proud of, and so there's things like that in Alabama too, and I mean even more so down here. I don't think people know about our ecosystems, maybe longleaf pines and forests, but that's about that's about as far as it gets. 99% of people don't know any other ecosystem in our state. So is that the only kind of ecosystem in New Jersey, or are there other kind of physiographic regions or types of
ecosystems? That's something we're really lucky, is we have such a diversity of ecosystems. Like I mentioned, the Pine Barrens, and even in the Pine Barrens, you'll have a lot of boggy areas. So you'll have that's another big agricultural product of the Pine Barrens is cranberries. New Jersey is one of the larger cranberry growers. I think it's New Jersey, Massachusetts, Wisconsin are like three of the biggest cranberry growers in the entire country. In fact, I was actually in New Mexico, and I was talking to a guy, and he found out I was from New Jersey, and we started talking about cranberries, and he's like, do they really stand in the water like that on the ocean spray commercials? They do.
But that's not how they grow, is it? That they don't grow in the water, right?
They don't grow in the water. They grow in wet bogs. Yeah, a lot of people think they're growing in the water. It's just a wetland, basically. But there's not standing water. And what they'll do with the cranberries is actually they control the water flow to that area of the bog. And when the harvest comes, they can beat the cranberries off. They basically beat the bushes with a tractor. They have a special tractor that will thrash and knock the berries loose. And then they flood it because the cranberries will float. At least the good ones will float. So now you have waist-deep water, and that's why they're standing in the bog with waders in the commercials, and all the berries are floating around because they're good, and they'll basically just kind of push them to these big conveyor belts, and you're pushing them on the conveyor belt, and it's just loading up trucks, and we have ocean spray, like, I wouldn't call them plants. It's not where they're making the juice, but where they'll consolidate the berries. There's a handful of them not too far away from us.
Man, that's awesome. Like, we're just south of its range. I think cranberries are native down to about North Carolina, which is kind of sad because it'd be awesome to have them around us. But they, I was at the Colowee Native Plant Conference, and somebody was talking about cranberries, and they were saying that they make a great plant to, like, to use in landscaping, or use, I think somebody said they were using them in pots, and like they're hanging over the sides or something. And they kind of draped over like English ivy or something would, but I've never seen that in person, so I don't know.
Yeah, it's a good point. I've never seen it like that, but I would imagine they'd work well in some people do those little bog gardens where they'll get like a decorative metal pot and then fill it with water and put in pitcher plants and different mosses. And I bet cranberries would work well in there.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just that industry popped up. Same with the blueberries because they grew there naturally. And with the blueberries, they really hybridized stuff and selected. So you can go to the store and you're getting like a big giant blueberry that tastes great. The wild ones, they look pretty similar. They're not as big as what you get in the store, but they can be a little bit more tart than what you're going to get at the store.
Yeah.
But those, the cranberries, the blueberries, they grew there. So that's why they just, that industry popped up. Mm-hmm. And so you have the bogs, and then you'll have a lot of like Atlantic white cedar that grows along some of those waterways and just like marshy conditions.
Yeah.
But then other ecoregions or ecosystems in New Jersey, in the northwest part of the state, you have a lot of, that's where we kind of get like foothills of mountains. Mm-hmm. Anyone out west is going to laugh at how tall our mountains are. They're not very big, but you have a completely different region there where the plant life is so different. And that's where we have our black bear population in New Jersey, is in the northern part of the state.
Yeah.
Then the one that's been most important to our nursery is actually the coastal region. So we grow a lot of stuff for sand dunes and salt marshes is the primarily our what we grow the most of is plants for those regions. We have, I think with all the like barrier islands and little nooks and crannies, we have so much coastline in New Jersey. And those environments are actually grasslands when you really think about it. It's just they're tolerant of salt conditions. So they all have a salinity tolerance.
Yeah.
And that's what makes is really unique too.
Yeah. So, what can the average like person in New Jersey do to kind of help these ecosystems? Are there, and I'm sure there's invasives taking over a lot of these places. If it's anything like the rest of the country, is there, you know, is there things that people can stop planting in New Jersey or things that, you know, they can look out for to kind of help these places or what's kind of what's the thing that's hindering these ecosystems the most?
A lot of it's just development. We're the most densely populated state in the country, and so we have a lot of people here already, and then everyone has their house and their driveway and their cars and all that kind of stuff. So you have a lot of the things there already that are impacting ecosystems. But then you tie in all the other things that people need. They need a grocery store. They need the roads to get places. So because we have so many people, we need not just more of those things, but bigger of those things too. We have so many like just super highways. And now, although it started to scale back a little bit, COVID kind of accelerated people home and they're shopping from home. So we have like a giant warehouse boom that's happening in New Jersey now, especially down where we are because we aren't as built up yet.
That's happening here too.
So, I think it's happening everywhere. we're seeing it right now pretty hard.
So, you know, to curb the development, it's probably best to move your in-laws in with you so that you're using less houses.
Get more people in. Yeah. But that's some of the complications with it. But we talk about Dr. Doug Talmy, and he says, oh, we need to have that homegrown national park. Mm-hmm. So we have this this issue where we just have so many people and all the stuff that comes along with them. Well, if everyone can kind of start to incorporate some native plants into their yards, or at least not use invasive plants.
Yeah.
Japanese barberry, in our business, we'll see site plans, and there's people still want to use Japanese barberry and Bradford pear, and because that's what they've used for a while, and they don't know that, one, there's alternatives, and two, that sometimes it's even causing a problem.
Yeah.
But there's a development right across the street from my house, and trying to follow in your footsteps and make some like Instagram and TikTok videos.
Yeah.
I really want to just go through there and just like point out all the plants that are in people's landscapes and say, hey, this is, here's burning bush, and the neighbor has one and the other neighbor has one, and you just keep going. Everyone has this exact same plant.
Yeah, and then go in the woods by the neighborhood and show exactly. the same plants there. People don't make that connection. I don't think, you know, that's the big thing. People never make that connection, and so they never realize what they're doing is harmful to these mm-hmm. ecosystems. Yeah. And if they think if they see it coming up out there, they, you know, probably don't think it's a bad thing. But
A lot of people don't even know it's there. At the back of our seed farm, we have a little patch of it's probably our seed farm property boundary. There's probably like 6 acres of woods in the back, but it backs up to a little wild area that was put in when a development got put in. They had to preserve this under like a Blue Acres, a Green Acres type space. And you go in there. So I'm probably 1,000 yards from any dwelling, like any house. And I'm finding a lot of privet, tons of honeysuckle. What was it? Japanese barberry we just talked about. Japanese stilt grass. And it's like, well, how did all this stuff get here? We're not near... any people, but so I've taken some videos of that where it's like, hey, okay, can see there's no houses in sight. You're still seeing some of these landscape plants that are safe for the landscape. Yeah. They're just popping up in the middle of the woods.
All right, y'all, we're excited to tell y'all about this week's sponsor for the podcast. And this is a company that we've had experience with for the past several years, and it's a great company. We're talking about Roundstone Native Seeds, and this is a company that's been growing and supplying high-quality, regionally adapted native seeds to the eastern half of the U.S. for over 25 years. And these guys are farmers and conservationists just like us that have grown from a small family-owned business to one of the largest seed providers in the East. And I can say from experience that you're not going to find a staff that's more friendly and knowledgeable than the staff at Roundstone Native Seeds. Plus, they have really high-quality, clean seed, and they've developed different ecotypes adapted to each region that they serve. And let me tell you, the reason they focus on quality and service is because every success that they bring to their customers is a living demonstration and incentive for others to use natives. Y'all go check out our friends at Roundstone Native Seeds.
You bring up a good point. I'm all about economic development. I mean, these businesses and industries are giving jobs that help people provide for their families. But it's all about education for these landscaping companies and just these residential homeowners on an individual basis. If everybody is a little more educated about it and they can make decisions where the landscaping that they use kind of helps offset what's been, you know, wild areas that have been displaced, you know, that's really going to make a difference. You mentioned Doug Tallamy's, homegrown national park. You know, that's just a really, really cool initiative. So,
I think it comes down to, you know, people need to learn more about those ecosystems in their states and their areas. And then once they learn more about them, they'll start respecting them. Mm-hmm. And then they'll say, hey, I'd like to have some of those plants in my landscaping. But, you know, it's going to take people on, you know, local scale to really highlight those ecosystems. And, you know, I was the same place you were. I was out looking and seeing all these invasives, and man, it just like, I had all these emotions. Like I was just angry that these plants that people are putting in their landscape and they think they're doing no harm. That's the thing, man. I feel bad that, you know, for past, you know, several generations, people have been planting things thinking that they weren't doing any harm, and they were. And now they're out in these, you know, ecosystems, and all I wanted to do was like tell the world about it. And that's, you know, I guess that's what started me making videos, is because I was just so upset about, you know, seeing these things. Sometimes Jake and I were in a yard last week. This landowner is awesome. They've had it in their family, what, a couple hundred years probably. This huge blackjack oaks, huge shortleaf pines, and because they're in such a developed part of our state with so many houses and really old neighborhoods, the back half of their property had, I mean, the whole lineup. The whole entire lineup was it a couple acre, like an acre or two? Yeah. And I couldn't find any natives in there.
It was like there was a species of invasive plant that came from, you know, kind of every generation of landscaping fad that came along.
You name it was there. And, I mean, there was a wisteria vine. I'm talking, it was as big around as your head.
Yeah, no
kidding. That's how the stem, it was like old growth wisteria. Yeah. It was crazy. God.
Yeah. Yeah, and then, you know, that kind of brings up another good point. There's so much of it on our landscape in a lot of areas that the average person wouldn't know that Asian privet or leatherleaf mahogany isn't supposed to be there. Isn't, you know, as far as most people would know, that's just a wild plant, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah. And that was one of the conversations we had actually on the first episode of our podcast was there's a place called Duke Farms who was the family there. You've heard of Duke University. That's why they paid to have it named Duke University. Mm. So very, very wealthy family that had this giant property. And I guess when the last heir was passing away, basically said, I want this to be for the people in a way, and I want to be maintained and be beautiful. And somewhere along their mission, they decided to make it primarily a native plant thing. But when the episode we were talking about it, and they're talking about how important invasive management was, invasive plant management was, just because if it was on there, people knew these plants were supposed to just be native plants. And if they saw a Japanese barberry, they're going to then have like social permission to say, oh, well, this must be a native plant. It must be a wild plant and a good plant, so I can have this at home. So that's why they were just so... so invested in making sure that they got rid of all the invasives. And they actually were able to, because they fenced off the entire property and then just really knocked down the deer population to a sustainable level. A lot of the research on going back to your question about where we have trouble and what we need to do, our deer population is just through the roof. It's probably one of the highest in areas in the country. Just as if you took a state, our state as a whole, our deer population has to be as high as anywhere else in the country. It's hard to even just have a residential landscape. Mm-hmm. So I understand why you want to use Japanese barberry and you want to use some of this stuff because it's deer resistant. Mm-hmm. They're not going to eat it because they don't like thorns or don't like certain things about it. But a lot of it's just getting those numbers back down to, I think historical levels should be around like 10 to 12 deer per acre. And we're at over 125 across most of the state. But at Duke Farms, they basically brought in sharpshooters, knocked down that deer population to that probably like 5 per acre. They couldn't, you can't get rid of all of them. And they said right around 30 deer per acre is where they started to see the native plants could actually outcompete the invasive plants. Wow. And when, and once the lower you got, then all of a sudden you didn't have an invasive plant problem because your native plants could outcompete the invasive plants.
That is something. People don't understand. That was,
I never thought about that's not our deer density, and especially the area I grew up, that's never been a problem. No. I never, you know, I've heard people mention that, but you know, these the wildlife that is adapted to consume these native plants, that's what they're going to select. And so, you know, they're going to chow those down when they're, man, it's hard for me to imagine even a 5 deer per acre density. I don't think I've ever hunted on a property in Alabama that had a density like that. That's wild.
So basically, like the folks who have, you know, who are out there, you know, against, you know, farming and agriculture and the meat production industry, I guess those are the folks who should be consuming things that are, you know, coming off the land and native habitat, because that's like about as green as you can possibly get. So they could be consuming deer meat and helping the environment. And to think that we're at a point where people are so disconnected from that there's too many deer.
Yeah,
man, that's like, who would have called that back, you know, 60 years ago?
Yeah. And I want to correct myself. I think I might have said 125 deer per square acre or per acre, and it was per square mile.
Okay, yeah.
So it's a lot bigger, bigger area. But still,
That's
like 125 per square miles is, if you like to hunt deer, it's a good thing because you have so many to choose from. Mm-hmm. But it's, I know. As we had a big outbreak of EHD directly in our area last year. And so estimates were it knocked down like 50 to 75% of the population. So you had 100 deer per square mile. Now you're at like 30 per square mile. Yeah. Still too high from the research we've seen, but from a hunting population, like the population of hunters, I should say, they weren't seeing any deer. I went out probably 30 times last year. I saw only a handful all year. And it's so you lose some of the hunters because it's a little quandary that a lot of the hunters find themselves in, because they like to say, oh, we're helping because we're reducing the deer is such a problem in the state, we're reducing the deer population, and then something else brought the deer population down, and then they complain that there aren't enough deer. So it's a little inconsistency, I guess, I can point out.
Yeah, and I'm sure it depends on the area of the state too. I'm sure it's just like Alabama. There's certain areas that have just way too many deer, and there's areas that don't have near as many deer. But
That's
I'm sure it fluctuates.
Everybody does it, but we as hunters definitely find ways to justify things, and our logic doesn't always quite line up with what we're doing. But
it sounds like they need to be killing more deer up there in New Jersey.
That's what the research has said. From like state researchers and even our Rutgers has done some research on it. There's a handful of different experts. They basically all come to the same conclusion. Hey, we need to knock down our deer population to a level where we can have native plant regeneration. And another guy we had on our podcast, who you guys should probably talk to too, is a guy, Dr. Jay Kelly. And he's 100% environmentalist. He's big into animal rights, and he basically framed it and says, my first instinct wasn't we need to kill deer, because that's like an animal rights issue in his mind. But when he really broke everything down, he's like, it's a bigger animal rights issue that we have too many deer. Because now you're decimating the native plant populations that so many other species and so many other animals need to survive. So by letting too many deer live, you're not allowing this whole diversity of wildlife to actually exist. And I'd never put it in that perspective until he said it. And I was like, man, that's a really interesting thing, because our governor is very is pro animal rights. I think overall, depending on how you phrase it, everyone's probably pro animal rights. It's just the level that you're on. So they've banned like the black bear hunt in New Jersey, which a lot of people are for. It's one of the things he actually ran on. A lot of people are like, oh, we don't want to kill black bears. But we're seeing it in northern New Jersey, where we have black bears, that they're getting into more people's yards and going through their trash and becoming a nuisance issue. And that's basically a result of not allowing, in my mind, is a result of not allowing hunting, where they're kind of keeping that population where it's meant to be. And that's what the state biologists all say. And I have a friend who was in that role at, like 15 years ago, and he said, oh yeah, I basically got fired because I was stuck in between the governor who didn't want to have a black bear hunt, and then the board of directors for wildlife management who did. And I have two bosses. They're both saying different things. There's no right answer for me, but he's very pro having a black bear hunt, just to keep a population. From an agriculture perspective, is destroying a lot of agriculture up there. I don't know what it's doing to our native habitats. And I haven't found anyone who can really answer that question. Is having too many black bears, how does it affect native habitats?
That's a good question.
And talking about the deer, not only does it affect the multitude of other species that they're taking food out of their mouths, but a deer herd that's that overpopulated, the deer themselves are not healthy. I mean, they're you could see their ribs all times of the year, and that's just not good. So and sure things like EHD are a lot more likely to spread when you have those high densities too.
And I'm sure there's a lot of ticks too because of that, because it's in those high deer density areas where I get a lot of ticks. And I'm sure that, you know, Lyme disease is a big thing up y'all's way. I think
real quick, I want to know, we haven't talked about the role of fire in your area. I'd be interested to know how prescribed fire is viewed in New Jersey as a whole?
That's an interesting question. And it's something that from most of the state doesn't have any experience with. But it's like a necessary thing for the Pine Barrens ecosystem that we talked about before. So the state actually goes through and does a lot of prescribed burns every year to prevent wildfires.
Yeah,
is their main motivation, because you have this, like I mentioned, the Pine Barrens is fairly rural, but you do have these pockets of population density kind of scattered on the fringes and some inside. So if you had a wildfire, you have a fair amount of people who are at risk pretty quick. And we've had some wildfires pop up, but the state will actually go through and just do prescribed burns on certain tracks every single year and just make sure they're burning. I don't know the exact number, but I would imagine it's probably like 20%, maybe 10 to 20% of the Pine Barrens they'll actually do prescribed burns on every year, just to kind of keep it under control. And I know it scares a lot of people, because it's also one of our main tourist attractions is the Jersey Shore, and we have all our beaches, and to get there you got to drive through the middle of the Pine Barrens, and you're driving through and both sides of the road are all charred and black, and it's like, oh man, what the heck happened here? But I'd imagine most people don't even know it's going on. Just we live fairly close and work in that industry.
In that far north, it might not be the temperatures and the climate might not be quite as extreme as what it is on like the Gulf Coast, but that's a coastal plain ecosystem, right? I mean, that's like our coastal plain. That's historically, that would have been like a 2-year return interval. So that's probably fairly similar to what would have been there. And it's just a natural process just to remove that fuel and reset everything.
And it's a necessary thing. We grow a lot of pitch pines at the nursery, and if we want to get the seeds out, we throw them in an oven for a certain amount of time until they open up. They need that heat from the fire to even just to have that next generation come on. Just for the seed to be available, you need the from the fire. And I'm sure you guys have similar ecosystems there too. But a lot of people don't understand that. And it wasn't until actually I talked to Dr. Dwayne Estes when we had him on our podcast that he was even describing some of the pine ecosystems, like pine savannas down there, and how they should look. And he was running through and saying, you probably have your pitch pines and really tight stem density, and it's a pretty close canopy. And then if you go down to like this, the floor level, you're going to have blueberries, you're going to have like inkberry holly, you're going to have, he named off like five things. And I'm like, well, I was just down there last week, and that's exactly what I saw was these. And he was saying, if you have the right fire regimen, you lower that, like basically the stem density with the pitch pines and all these other trees, and you let some light through, all of a sudden your plant diversity just goes through the roof. And that was, I belong to a gun club down there, and we have a little area where we thinned out the pine trees so we can do some trap shooting. And right on the fringe of there, that's where you see there's an explosion of plant diversity. Is right on the edge where you start getting that more sunlight through, that's where you see more plants. But once you're in the closed canopy, there's not a lot of plant diversity. It's different than what you're going to see across the rest of the state. And even along the highways, when you're going through that area, that's where you start seeing a whole bunch more species of plants is right once you have that light getting through and hitting the ground. And then you have people go along and mow it because for the DOTs. But so that was just something he brought up that was interesting as well.
He's a national treasure.
We got to get him on our podcast too, hopefully. We might not quite be where y'all's podcast is yet, but maybe we can convince him
we got
to
go.
You should be able, you know him well enough too, so you should be able to convince him to come on.
I know him enough to know how busy he is too. I appreciate you coming on. Do you want to give a plug for y'all's podcast?
Yeah, so our podcast is called Native Plants, Healthy Planet, and I've kind of laid out just through bits and pieces what we do, but it was basically just a way to connect people with groups that they could they were passionate about. So whether you like birds or quail or turkeys, butterflies, snakes, whatever you liked, they all tied back to native plants. All these groups that we're working with were doing a lot of the same stuff, just with different angles in mind. And not everyone's going to be interested in plants, but they're going to be interested in, hopefully they're interested in one of these other topics. And this is a way to kind of tie it all together. Yeah. So,
and y'all are doing series, like a native plant a day, aren't you?
Yeah, we did that last winter. We started another podcast called Native Plant Every Day, where basically my co-host Fran would start with a little quiz and just kind of give five facts about the plant. I'd have to guess. I was probably like 50-50 on whether I got it right or not on a good day, I guess. And then just kind of go through some of the intricacies of that plant. And it was a good format because you got a lot of information.
Yeah.
The bad part of it is you weren't seeing any pictures. So,
yeah.
But we were hoping to bring it back for the summer and just we're way too busy with our normal jobs. Mm-hmm. Our goal is this winter to start that back up again, do another like 40 or 50 plants and then get it back out there.
Well, man, we saw one of y'all's shirts. We were at that prescribed burn manager training a couple weeks ago and saw a Native Plants Healthy Planet podcast shirt in our classroom. It was the ones y'all were selling that say native plant or plant native plants and great lady doing prairie restoration on her property. It was cool to see some of y'all's podcast listeners down here in Alabama. Yeah. So
yeah, I was glad you sent it to me because it's we started that and basically said we have this audience that this is a way to get more of that native plant message out there, is have people actually wear it. So I have some shirts, Fran has some shirts. We both gotten compliments when we wear them just from the normal crowd. Like we're at a state park and the park ranger says, oh yeah, I like your shirt. Yeah. But that was a way to get it out there. So people all over the country were now wearing a shirt that said plant native plants and or eat native plants or is wild about native plants. We have a whole bunch of different ones out there. And it wasn't for us to make any money off of because we basically said we want to give this to people who deserve it.
Yeah.
And it was actually when we talked to you, Kyle, the first time, we're like, man, we had just started this, the t-shirts then. And like, man, he's doing a lot of this on his own. And it was only like $500 or $1,000, I think we gave you, but it was going to go a lot further with someone like you than a bigger organization that has a ton of donation dollars already. Yeah. So,
I know I appreciated it. And that was in the early days where we were just starting up and I wasn't quite at that point yet where I was, you know, could commit to this full time, but, it was a huge help. I can't remember if I had the signs by then or not. I think I might have used some of that on getting some of those no mow, no spray signs. It was a huge help. So if you like our podcast, go check out Native Plants Healthy Planet. I've been listening for years. It's a great podcast and love what you guys do. And I hate Fran couldn't be on here, but that just means that we can use him for a last minute podcast.
I was gonna say it gives you more content if you need someone last minute again, you can shoot a message to him and get him on. So
you guys have a really cool dynamic. You kind of play the role of you're the hunter, the outdoorsman, and then Fran, I mean this with all due respect, Fran is more of the typical personality you would associate with the native plants. So it's fun to hear you guys riff back and forth. Y'all are a good combination.
Thank you. That goes a long ways with getting people into native plants, I think.
And that's one of the things we found interesting with our listener base too, is you have folks who really love Fran and like they're so on me, and then they have people the other way too, just because they I don't want to say resemble, because I hope people don't look like me. That would probably be a bad thing, but they can see they have a similar life experience what I might have or what Fran might have. And we can kind of pick up some different listeners that way.
Yeah.
So
we each
have our own little cliques our own little groupies, I guess, in a way.
But you've spent some time down south, haven't you? Did you go to school?
No, so I went to school in upstate New York, and I actually was just back up there this weekend talking about invasive plants, and I was up in the Adirondacks, and I was just amazed at how much Japanese knotweed I saw. And you're talking about a place that really has very low population density. And it's like, where the heck did all this stuff come from? That it's you're on a hike and you're miles from the nearest house and you're finding it.
Yeah, and, I saw some in Tennessee for the first time ever last week. It was a big patch of it too. I'd never seen it before. So, that's scary.
Hopefully, it stays further north.
Yeah, I need to go spray it. But, anyways, I appreciate it, Tom, and thanks for coming on last minute, and thanks for setting a good example for New Jersey and putting in so much work for native plants on y'all's podcast. So,
all right, thank you guys.
Yeah, appreciate it. We'll see you later.
Thanks, man.
Thanks.
I'll see you.
Bye.